I feel honored to be here as a speaker tonight. Usually I'm here as the presenter or the listener. Tonight I get to do some talking, and especially on the topic that is scheduled for this evening's talk, I'm happy to be doing that. The topic is karma and rebirth in Buddhism, and I'm obviously very interested in the Buddhist teachings. And so I have an invested interest in trying to encourage a correct understanding of the Buddhist teachings. And so this forum is an opportunity for me to share with you my understanding regarding karma and rebirth in Buddhism from the early Buddhist tradition, the Theravada tradition. And the authority for the Theravada tradition are the what we think to be the more original text, scriptural material, which records the teachings of the Buddha. How accurate they are can be challenged and questioned by anybody, obviously, but they are the earliest records of his teaching. And even though the Buddha lived a very long time ago, 2,500 years ago and more, and that his teaching was preserved in an oral tradition, which was the norm actually in India, for many hundreds of years. This, I don't think, needs to suggest that these records are not a pretty accurate record of the general thrust of the Buddhist teachings and some of the specific, unique characteristics of his teachings. I don't think that they are just inaccurate simply because they were not written down immediately when he spoke them. Nor do I think that they are inaccurate because it has been such a long time. And I say this because the teachings of the Buddha are sufficiently vast. He taught for 45 years, and he had an extremely large following of disciples who trained under him for a lifetime, you could say. And they, in turn, passed on this teaching. So it's vast, and it's in detail, and it's the theme is repeated many, many times. It's not just once, and then somebody heard it once, and that was it. The theme is repeated over and over again, and it's recorded in various parts of the scriptures. So the point I would like to make is that I think that the Buddhist teachings on the central principles that he wanted to make are accurately recorded. They are available and have been available, and today they are available in English because we have modern scholars who now translate extremely well, and these early teachings have been translated into very good English. And this was not the case just a few hundred years ago, or even 100 years ago. It's only in the, 50 years or so. So these teachings are available to us. So for me, the teachings of the Buddha are something precious, and I feel it a bit of an obligation, or maybe a little bit of an honor to be able to share my understanding based on this information in order to try and encourage, understanding in others that is in conformity with these early teachings. Because I think it's very easy for things to be, different people have different interpretations. Karma is now almost an English word. We use it in English, it's used commonly. And people mean different things by it. Different traditions mean different things by it. Karma is also used in Hinduism. Exactly what they mean by it, or in the Hindu tradition, it's maybe different. Theosophists use the word karma. Theosophists speak about reincarnation. Hinduism speaks about reincarnation. Buddhists talk about rebirth. Are all these things the same or not? And so this evening, I'd like to just try as briefly as I can, as is already drawing out, try as briefly as I can to highlight some of the characteristics of these teachings that are specifically Buddhist and maybe a little different than how these terms are used by other traditions. And the word karma itself is a neutral word. Literally, its root just means action, doing. However, and it was a common word, like doing is a common word in English. The way that the Buddha used that word was much more specific. And he was not using the word karma as action. He was using the word karma as volitional action. He actually said, "Cetanahang bhikkhave kammang vadami." It is volition that I call karma, or volition is what I call karma. So as far as the Buddha and the Buddhist teaching was concerned, when he uses the word karma, he's interested in and wants to point to the volition behind the action, not just the action, not just any action. It's the volition that creates karma. And so this is quite, you know, again, it's an emphasis that's very important because you cannot know someone else's volition. You may speculate, but you see somebody doing something, you don't know their volition. You have no, there's no way to you for you to know what karma they're making. And unfortunately, a good portion of the time, we are not very conscious or aware of our own volitions. And therefore, we are not always very conscious or aware of the sort of karma that we are creating. And because volition is associated with every conscious moment, volition is a concomitant that is present with every moment of consciousness. And when I'm using the word consciousness, it's not only when you're awake, it's every mind moment. And so it is something that is present. We are creating karma, if you wish, every moment, because there is volition in every moment. Most of the volition is not that strong, it's not so important, and the karma we create is nothing of any great consequence. But it is something that is part of our life. We are continually creating karma. And it is something that to live is to will, and if we will as an unenlightened being, someone who's preoccupied with the concept or the belief in a self as a separate entity, our actions are continually coming from that perspective. It's volition that creates karma. So karma here in the Buddhist tradition does not mean result. It's not, often people use karma as saying that it's the result of, it's what happens. But karma is what you create, what you bring forth, what you bring out, what you generate. It's dynamic. It's something that you're generating. The result in the Buddhist scriptures is given a separate term. It's called karma vipaka or kammapala. It's like the fruit or the result. So there are two separate terms. There is the volitional action that we generate, and then there is this other term which refers to the result. And the law of karma is understanding the relationship between these two. That's what the law of karma is exploring, the relationship between the volitional action and the consequences that come from it. Now, this law of karma is just one aspect of a much broader, a much more all-encompassing law that is fundamental to the Buddhist teaching. And this is the law of conditioned arising or dependent origination. The Buddha discovered, if you wish, or realized, if you want, something about how existence, and existence, when I use this word, I mean everything in existence, okay? If it exists, it's in here, it's in this bubble. And existence is this conditioned arising. If it exists, it is within this law. This law is existence. And this law is, the Buddha wasn't interested in, he refuted actually. He refuted the belief of many, the extremes. One of them is the idea that existence or life is all predetermined and destined to be in a particular way according to the power of an omnipotent, omniscient God, or some power, whatever, impersonal, but it's a predetermined mechanical system. It's meant to be that way. It's meant to happen that way. It's already existing. And this is, it's not easy for anyone to really, uphold that. Because, and if anyone really believes that everything is predetermined and already fixed, why would anybody bother making any effort to create or shape one's life? So this very mechanical, predetermined, fatalistic view of life is not part of Buddhism. The other one, that life is somehow, haphazard and not much order in it, things don't really follow any kind of rule of any sort, it's just whatever happens, happens, is another extreme that the Buddha did not uphold. He pointed rather to this middle way, that there is order within existence. There is order, and the order is the relationship between causes and effects, causes and results. And this is the universal law of conditioned arising. When these conditions exist, these results come about. When these conditions do not exist, these results cannot come about. With the arising of these conditions, these results arise. When these conditions cease, those results cease to exist. It's a very kind of nice way of just stating that everything is interrelated, interdependent, and it is in an orderly manner, that it's the conditions that bring about a result. It's not some power that's inexplicable, or the wish of somebody, or even your wish. Your wish is not sufficient to bring about a result unless the conditions that support it are there. Your wish is one factor, though. In other words, volition is one of the factors that can bring about results. So this universal law of conditioned arising is applicable to every facet of life and every facet of existence, or everything in the realm of mortality, in the realm of birth and death, in any realm, past, present, future, refined, coarse, hells, heavens, physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual. It's applicable to everything. A law of causality or conditionality, dependent arising. When this universal law is, applied to the relationship between volition and the result, karma and the result. We call it the law of karma. So it's just one facet of the bigger law. The law of karma is the relationship between volitional action, which is karma, and what's the consequence of it? It's something that's been put into motion. It's a seed. Something has been generated. The Buddha says, this is, you've put this energy, has been generated, put forth, it brings about a result. Understanding that relationship is having understanding of the law of karma. And the Buddha had a very clear understanding of this, because on the night of his enlightenment, the two insights, the first two insights that he had on the night of his enlightenment, the first one, the knowledge arose in him, the recollection of past lives. Not one life, not two, not 100 or 1,000. Innumerable past lives in detail, with no beginning to be seen. And this is from the Buddha. It's recorded. It's broadly accepted by Buddhists of all tradition. So he actually recollects this process of past lives, passing away, being reborn. And the second knowledge that arose in him was the divine eye, they call it dipajaku, the vision that, not really, it's not a visual vision, it's the knowledge of seeing how beings are born, pass away, and are reborn according to their karma. So he could actually see how beings, when they, how they live, what they do, when they pass away, the consequence, where they're reborn. So this relationship of cause and result was very clear to the Buddha in regards to karma and the results of karma. And so he made that quite a central part of his teaching. He did not make it a dogma that, you know, to be a Buddhist, you have to believe in rebirth. If you don't believe in rebirth, you just can't be a Buddhist. I'm sorry. There's nothing like that in Buddhism. It's not the approach. The Buddhist was explicit in his teaching, clear, precise, detailed. But he always offered it for investigation. If you don't know, you don't know. But you can have an open mind to inquire and try and find out, because his teaching is something that can be verified each for oneself. So with regards rebirth, let's leave that for a moment. If we are a little bit hesitant to consider that, let's just come back to the law of karma, the relationship between the volition and the result. Karma is volition. We create, we will, and we intend. There's intention with every moment of consciousness. So we're creating karma. What is the nature of that volition? What is the quality of that volition? Well, the quality of the volition, as the mind is not just a lump, it's not just mind, it's not just conscious moment. Every conscious moment has many concomitants, if you wish, or aspects to it. Volition, what's associated with that volition? Volition doesn't stand by itself with nothing else. Associated with that volition are the mental qualities or factors, concomitants, co-arising. And the mental factors that co-arise can be positive or negative. That volition may come from positive or negative roots. It comes from certain roots, if you wish. And when we say, I like the word positive and negative, I like those two words, because they do not denote any sense of moral judgment. It's kind of a neutral term, positive and negative. We don't really know what it means. It's not like electric charge. But it's, what does it mean positive? What does it mean negative? We'd like to explore that. But the Buddha talked about these roots associated with the volition as the things that give volition its quality. These roots can be of a certain nature that give volition that quality, or therefore that karma, a quality that brings about a particular type of result. Okay? So these roots, the Buddha divided them into two groups, the positive roots and the negative roots. In the Buddhist terminology, he used the word kusala and akusala, usually translated as wholesome or unwholesome, skillful or unskillful. You could say healthy or unhealthy. In common parlance, we say good, bad. More theistic, good and evil. I like positive and negative. Or wholesome and unwholesome is the more traditional, but positive and negative. And say that the negative roots, Buddhists always seem to start with the negative ones. The negative roots, so volition associated with, that come from these seeds or come from these roots of greed or hatred or aversion. Lobha, dosa, moha. These are the three basic unskillful, unwholesome roots. Greed, aversion, delusion. Greed, hatred, delusion. And every synonym to those words. Those roots, those roots, any one of them, whether it's greed, a selfish motivation, or a motivation of aversion or hatred, anger, or just stupidity, ignorance, deluded, careless, mindlessness. When we come from those, we're creating a type of karma that we say is unwholesome, unhealthy, unskillful. And the volition is expressed through either body or speech or just in the mind itself. We're generating, we're creating all the time. We're generating and we're acting in this creating all the time. Even when we're dead still, zipped up, it's very rare that we're not generating thinking. And thinking is an act. It's something we're generating. It's energy. And if this action through either body, speech, or mind is coming from the volition associated with greed, hatred, and delusion, it's generating negative karma, akusala karma. The intensity of that karma is determined by the intensity of the volition, the intensity of the roots, and the duration, how many times we keep on generating. The opposite of those negative roots, the Buddha called kusala, positive roots. So the volition can also come from positive roots, which are the opposite of those three. Instead of greed, it can come from unselfishness. Instead of hatred, it can come from goodwill. Instead of delusion, it can come from clarity, knowledge, wisdom, awareness. It can come from these. When the volition is associated with these roots, that generation, that bringing forth, that creation, we call positive karma. It's karma that's being brought either through action through body, action through speech, action through mind, that has positive energy, wholesome. Why do we call it positive? Why do we call it negative? This, the Buddha said, is in relation to what are the consequences of it. Positive is the reason I like positive, because what it means is that it adds to, and it adds to what we aspire to, which is happiness, well-being. So kusala, or wholesome, or positive karma, is when we generate and we create that which is conducive, that which is likely to bring about positive well-being, an increase in well-being, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being. That's why it's positive. That's why we call it good. That's all. It's not a moral judgment. It's got nothing to do with a moral judgment. It's just a natural law, and it's that which is conducive to well-being, that which is conducive to growth and maturation towards physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being. We call that a wholesome path, a positive path. That karma is good karma, if you wish, and the result of it will be inclining towards well-being. So that's the good and the bad of it. It's not a moral judgment that somebody says anything. It's the Buddha doesn't have to decide what is good or bad. It's the law. It's the law that functions in this perfectly neutral. There's no reward for you doing good. There's no punishment for you doing bad. There's just, if you wish, the consequences, the relationship. You generate this condition is the seed that brings about this type of fruit. If you don't want this type of fruit, don't generate this type of seed. If you don't want a mango, don't plant a mango seed. It's just, so the seeds are the karma. The karma is the volition. The volition is associated with the roots. By generating the right volition, we are contributing to the consequences or the destiny or the future that we may want to try and create. So that's the law of karma. It's, you know, it's like a very simple, but the complexity of it is unthinkable, okay? The Buddha said that one of the things that is unthinkable, in the sense that you cannot think, conceive through thought, is the consequence or the result of karma, because there are so many variables. But the principle is easy to understand. But if you want to know the specific result of this karma, why did that, you'd have to be a Buddha. And I think we're all falling far short of that. But we need only to understand the principle. We don't have to know the explicit details. The relationship is the important thing. So volitional karma, that is something we generate. It's will, volition, intention. Where is it coming from? We can know that. And we can actually choose not only what sort of volition, but whether to act on the volition or not. And especially when we're cultivating the path, the more awareness we have, the more empowerment there is for us to shape our destiny. That's why human birth is quite precious. And that's why we are different from ordinary animals. They don't quite have the same freedom to choose. So this is the law of karma. When will the karma that we are generating give fruit, bring about a result? And this, the Buddha said, can happen either in this life or next life or in some future lives. And this is why karma and rebirth have to be kind of considered together. Because if we really look at one life, just one life, it's just not long enough for the law of karma to really balance out. That's why people don't question it. That's why people say, well, I know a lot of good people who do a lot of good things, and just a lot of stuff happens to them. Everything goes wrong. They lose their house. They lose their car. They didn't do anything. I don't think this law of karma is, I just don't believe in it. In one lifetime, you cannot see the full balance. In one lifetime, there is no, doesn't seem to be, not that it has to be fair, but balanced. Not that it has to be, the words fair or justice are not the right words. It's not a matter of justice like judging. It's a matter of balancing. like you're an accountant balancing your in and out. In one lifetime, it doesn't seem fair at all. Just this discrepancy there, the amount of suffering that some people have to endure, the amount of trouble and anguish and discomfort, sickness, why do they get all that? Why? They haven't done it to anything. One lifetime, the law of karma doesn't balance out and it doesn't make sense. It's true, I'd agree with that. And that's why in Buddhism, it's not one lifetime. It's beginningless beginning, countless lifetimes. And so one really has to at least have an open mind towards the idea of rebirth, if you wish, reincarnation. Buddhists don't like the word reincarnation because it's misleading. It's implying something that's not there. They prefer rebirth just to distinguish themselves. So this process of rebirth, is it so difficult for us to accept? These days it's not so radical, I don't think. Many, many people are much more open-minded about it. But even in the time of the Buddha, it was a hot topic of debate. There were a lot of people who are materialists. This is one life, you die, that's it, it's finished, goodbye. There are others who believed in a soul and they believed in once you die, your soul lives on forever. Just like today, people haven't changed that much. People believe all sorts of things. So the idea rebirth, what is birth? I mean, how do we get here? And so the materialistic view is that there is conception through the sperm and the ovum coming together and you've got conception, and maybe modern biology would say that's birth of a human being. Buddhists find that very difficult to accept. It's not Buddhist teaching. Buddhist teaching says that matter, just the sperm and the egg together, cannot produce a living human being, cannot produce the consciousness of a human being. Consciousness of the human being does not come from the matter. It does not come from the father, it doesn't come from the mother, the ovum, the sperm. That's just material, it's a condition. Buddhists often say that consciousness has to come from consciousness. And so for Buddhists, the term conception requires three factors: the sperm, the egg coming together, but a third factor is what they call the rebirth consciousness, patisanti vijnana, or gandhava. Gandhava is a really good term because it depends who translates it. I like the one translation, it translated as the stranger. The stranger. And so this rebirth consciousness has to, again, this is the Buddhist teaching, has to come. The condition for it arising has to be a previous consciousness, a previous moment of consciousness. It does not come from the egg, from the ovum or the sperm. It is something, a third factor. And so the conception requires that a spark of consciousness is generated. This relinking consciousness is generated. What conditions it is the question from the Buddhist perspective. What conditions it? Where and why and why does it arise in that environment of that ovum and that sperm and this spark of consciousness arises? What conditions it? Because I said that, everything in creation comes from condition, causes and results. What conditions this? It doesn't come from the matter. Where does it come from? What is it? Who comes? Is there anything that comes? And so this is a kind of a good question. And maybe to make this a little clearer, let's go to the other end of the spectrum, to what's waiting for all of us, my friends, gathered together here, all in the same boat, rowing along until what's waiting. We're all old enough. We're all old enough to live and to die. Everyone is young enough to live, and everybody's old enough to die. And all of us will meet this moment, hopefully not soon. But it is a mystery to us. We don't really know. I mean, if we're honest, and I think that's the best approach, is, you know, we believe various things, but as an immediate thing, I don't really know. But so what is the Buddhist teaching on this death? What happens? Well, what is death is that the physical body is either due to old age or to sickness or to some accident, no longer able to be the vehicle for experiencing and being and becoming for the mind. The mind is driven by this, blinded by ignorance, led by craving, this thirst to be an experience, okay? The body is just the instrument. And so death, certainly the body means the body is no longer a suitable instrument. That's why the body stops functioning. When it stops functioning, what happens to it? It just goes back to where it came from. Everything in your body came from where? This planet, the earth. Matter, it goes back, it just goes back to where it goes. Now, what about mind? And if you're not quite sure what I'm talking about, just consider yourself and then think of the corpse. Is there any difference? Well, there's something in us that's animating. That's the life force. Okay, what happens to that? Where does it go? Does it just also extinguished? That's the materialistic view would say, yeah, the ones the body's defunct, it's extinguished, there's nothing left. But it's questionable. It's questionable because this mind, and the Buddha's teaching again, mind is the forerunner. Mind is that which leads and creates. This mind is that which generated all of this. This makes your body get up and go to work and go and eat and go to the toilet and go and do. And look, everything that's being brought into existence by humanity is through the power of the mind. This will, this force, this thirst to be and to experience is the greatest force. It is the greatest force in the universe. So, the body is defunct. What happens? This is kind of something we'll just have to find out. But one thing we could maybe look at is what's happening now. Before that moment, what's been happening these moments? In actual fact, from the beginning of life, as that you can remember anyway, this process has been happening all the time within this body. Everything has been continually changing at a physical level, but also on the mental level. Your mind is not a static thing. It's not just a lump that sort of floats around in your brain, unchanging. Your mind is a stream. It's flowing, it's changing, it's arising and passing. Each volitional conscious moment arises and passes away. The mind is continually changing. You are not the same person you were 20 years ago. And I'm not only referring to your physical body. The physical body changes much more slowly than the mind. The mind is changing all the time. And change means something arises, passes away, something new arises, passes away. So it's this. And when something arises and passes away, it conditions. Then everything, what you are, is the result of your past conditioning. So this process is actually happening all the time. Now the question is, at the moment of death, is it likely that it's going to cease, or is it more likely that that last moment of consciousness will generate the next moment of consciousness, but maybe not in this body because this body is defunct? Is that possible? That's kind of a bit of a radical leap, because, you know, we can, within the body, we could say there's some continuity. Well, it's all happening in here, which is just just the way it appears. It's not really. Mind is, you can't say it's all in here. It's not really in here. But is it, do you think it's possible that maybe the moment of death, this consciousness, the last moment of consciousness, conditions the arising of a new moment of consciousness, just like it's been doing all along, except that it won't be in this body? It's not a big leap. But fortunately, quantum mechanics seems to make this easier to accept by modern people, but the idea of a non-localized, that it, you know, ceases there, rises there, within, it's not necessarily associated with any particular matter. So the Buddha's teaching on this is actually that one of the functions of karma is to condition the rebirth. That the last moment of consciousness in this life is the karma, that volition of the last moment of consciousness generates the rebirth consciousness. It just causes. It is just the, from this cause comes this result. The quality of this cause, of this volition, will determine the quality of the rebirth consciousness. In other words, what is that consciousness like? Where will it be comfortable, if you wish? In what environment will this consciousness fit in? So the rebirth is the continuity of the process. The continuity of the process. So one of the basic teachings of Buddhism is that there is no permanent personal entity or self or soul. And people say, well, that's pretty hard to believe. But it's true. It doesn't matter whether you believe it or not. It's something to be realized. But then they have a great deal of problem when you say, well, but there is rebirth. Aha! You just said there's no permanent personal self. Who's reborn then? Nobody's reborn. There's nobody now, so nobody's reborn. What's reborn? Nothing's reborn. Well, it's just from cause and result. It's just a relationship. It's the process that continues. Why does it continue? Because the person at the moment of death is still ignorant. The person at the moment of death is still infatuated, in love with mortality, blinded by ignorance, led by craving. The thirst to be an experience, that force is still alive, vibrant. The fire is still there. The virus is still alive. The virus of ignorance. The thirst to be an experience is what keeps the process going. So the moment of death causes the rebirth consciousness, relinking consciousness. Where does it occur? I mean, where is the rebirth? Buddhists have lots of heavens for you to go to, lots of hells for you to go to. There are 31 realms. The human realm is the fifth one. There are lower realms, and these the Buddha called the unfortunate rebirths. And because they are realms where there is more pain, less choice, more pain and less freedom. So the hell realms, animal realms, asura realms, these are very volatile, jealous gods sort of creatures. Hungry ghosts, these are the most common ones that people are actually, who are very sensitive to astral planes or to some other realms. The hungry ghost realm is very close to the human realms, and it's just these beings who are still very attached to they want to be part of. So there's this realm, then there's the human realm, and above the human realm there are the what we call the celestial realms, sensual realms, and then beyond the sensual realms, the fine form realms of the Brahma gods and higher. It goes, lots of realms. And you think, wow, how come? Why? Well, what is the quality of the mind at that last moment? What is the karma? What is the volitional quality of the mind? If the last moment of life is so important, why can't we just choose where to be reborn? Most of us don't have that clarity of mind, that presence of mind. So what determines, there are a few factors that will determine the rebirth. People who've really, created some heavy karma, some really bad or good, some really powerful imprints have been laid in their conscious stream. Like kill your parents, kill your mother, kill your father. That's going to, at the moment of death, that such heavy karma will just push its way to consciousness. That's what's going to determine the rebirth. And the rebirth for a negative karma like that is not going to be a nice one. On the other hand, if somebody's developed really, really good meditation, if you've been able to develop states of absorption, states of really pure, refined mind states, that mind at the moment of death, that's what's going to push it towards really refined realms. For most of us, it's habitual karma that determines the rebirth. That's why we say we're creatures of our habits. It's not necessarily that the karma is so big and heavy, but it's the one that we're most frequenting, we're generating the most of, most frequently. And that's the one that we feel comfortable in, and that's the one that's going to determine the rebirth. And so what will that be? For most human beings, it's a human rebirth, just ordinary. But not too good, not too bad, both. But it's something as human beings, that's what the human birth is. We've got a lot of good karma, but we've got a lot of not such good karma. But it's considered a very favorable rebirth. So there's this moment of consciousness comes up. The being is born. That being inherits the genetic material from the parents. It inherits its own, the karmic inheritance from its past, endless past. So you don't come with a clean slate. You don't come empty, an empty shell. You come with a lot of stuff, good and bad. And then as you mature and grow, this being grows, the influence of the environment come in. And this being grows and eventually starts having the mental capacity to will and choose, and again, creates karma. The present karma interacts with the conditions that are there. You are in those conditions because of your past karma. In the present, we act and we will and we create, interacting with the present, we generate new karma. And so this is the stream, the cycle of samsara, blinded by ignorance, led by craving, beings roam in the realm of samsara, being born, passing away from one realm to another realm to another. No realm is permanent. No birth in any realm is permanent. That's got its puzzle, you know, it's unfortunate if you're in a good space, but it's really a relief if you're in a bad space. At least you know that none of them are permanent. None of them are permanent. And as far as the karma, does every karma that we create have to give fruit? The Buddhist teaching on this is no. Some karma, as the Buddha said, will give fruit during this lifetime. It's usually weak karma. If it doesn't give fruit during this lifetime, then it just fizzles out. Some karma can carry through to the next lifetime. But if it's not, the conditions are not right for it to express a result, it fizzles out too. But if it's important karma, if it's something that's of significance, it'll hang around. It'll be in your store of karma. It's going to give fruit sometime when the conditions are right. Mm-hmm. Karma is not static, because we are continually to live is to make new karma. So the karma we create now can counteract some tendencies of the past. It can even eliminate some tendencies of the past. That's why it's dynamic, it's changing. We can grow. And so this idea of karma is a fatalistic thing, well, it's just my karma. It's not like that. Think of it as, this is my choice. Now, the other thing is, a question that I would like to pose that's an important thing is, everything that happens to you because of your karma, the result of your karma. And this one is a little more delicate. Indirectly, yes. Everything that happens to you because you're born. Right. So, and you're born because of your karma. You know, you're born as a human being, as a woman, or as a man. So certain things happen to you because you were born. But a lot of the thing, and that's indirectly due to karma, but it doesn't mean that everything that you experience is directly the result of a karma that you generated in the past. You're born as a human being. You walk outside, you're going to feel cold. Is that because you put somebody in a bath of ice-cold water in your past life? No. It's sufficient. You've got a human body, you go outside, you feel cold. It's not the result of your karma, it's just you're a human being. Indirectly, you could say, well, you were born with a human body. If you were born as a bear, you'd probably enjoy it out there now. You wouldn't feel cold. But, so, not everything that happens to us, should be pointed, oh, it's your karma. Like in a way that it's some, absolute, rigid, mechanical, one-to-one. It's not like that. But the important things, if it's of significance, yes. And when I say of significance, what is that? Like, some illness, some of the people who, especially people who are born with some physical limitations or health issues, severe health issues. And I mean like getting a cold. You're a human being, you can catch a cold. But to some really severe health issues could be the result of past karma. More than likely the result of past karma. Some things that are really, hard to bear. On the other hand, some really good things that happen to you, if it's, it's just out of the ordinary. this guy never gets sick. It's kind of unusual. You'd have to say, well, it's probably from something from the past. And the Buddha did give a kind of a list of associations for things that are likely due to past karma. And they're usually things that stand out in your life as quite significant. So significant things, either very positive or very negative, are probably the result of some karma, but not everything, okay? And we've all got a storehouse of past karma. Okay? Because again, the Buddha says that it's no beginning is to be seen. This stream has been flowing for a long time. And so this, the karma is the idea that we can use up all our karma. I'm here to use up all my karma. That was another common practice in the time of the Buddha. The naked ascetics of the time used to practice severe austerities in order to burn up past karma. It's just impossible to burn up all past karma. It's an infinite, but there is the possibility of, I said there was a possibility of creating positive karma, maybe counteracting some negative karma, and the greatest opportunity is to bring about an end to karma and rebirth. And that's what the essential thrust of the Buddha's teaching was. He certainly taught the law of karma as a way to, help us kind of maybe make the right choices as to what we generate in life, to avoid many of the hardships, to try and create a better life. But the main thrust of it was to understand the basic flaw of this realm with mortality, and to find an end. And the end is the eradication of ignorance and the abandonment of craving, thirst. Without ignorance and no thirst, there no longer is this energy, this drive to be and experience, because we are finally awake to the fact that mortality cannot give us what we want from it. And when we, the realization of that, what happens? Process just stops, that's it. And there is no need for a rebirth. Now that's the goal of the Buddha's teaching, and that's why he said, I teach one thing, is the suffering and the end of suffering. Or if you wish, understand the nature of this mortality so well that you come to the realization that this is not where you belong. Now, just to finish off, because I would really like to take questions, because this is a vast topic, and my knowledge of it is not as vast as it should be. My ability to live what I know is even smaller. And what I don't know about it is probably the greatest. But I am always interested in taking questions, so that, because this is the sort of topic that I know there will be questions on. So I'm going to leave time for that. I just want to read you a couple of things. One of the things that is probably, it's very, with regards theosophy, it's quite a fundamental difference with the teaching of the Buddha. Killing, stealing, unlawful sexual intercourse, lying, slandering, rude speech, foolish babble, if practiced, carried on, and frequently cultivated, leads to rebirth in hell or amongst the animals or amongst the ghosts. So the idea that human beings are so evolved that they can never go back is not in accordance with the Buddha's words. Human beings are evolved that we have a great deal of choice. Choice comes responsibility. That's why we create karma. That's what karma is, it's responsibility. The consequences of it is that you can go down just as easily as you can go up. It's not a one-way street. Humans live in ways, generate the karma that is negative. The rebirth will be in a lower realm. It's nothing, it's perfectly normal. And they can go higher. That's the beauty or the privilege of being a human being. So that is one distinction of the Buddhist teaching of karma and rebirths from, say, the Hindu and the theosophy. The other big one, of course, is the idea of a soul transmigrating or, you know, going from one life to another. So I'll finish off with this. It's a couple of paragraphs, so bear with me. It's really interesting, though. A real and, in the ultimate sense, true understanding of Buddhist karma doctrine is possible only through a deep insight into the impersonality and conditionality of all phenomena of existence. Everywhere, in all the forms of existence, such as one is beholding merely, in other words, one is only observing, merely mental and physical phenomena kept going by their being bound through causes and effects. And this is what the Buddha says. No doer does he see behind the deeds, no recipient apart from the karma fruit. And with full insight, he clearly understands that the wise ones are using merely conventional terms when, with regards to the taking place of any action, they speak of a doer. Or when they speak of a receiver of the karma results at their arising, they speak of a receiver. Therefore, the ancient masters have said, no doer of the deeds is found, no one who ever reaps their fruits. Empty phenomena roll on. This view alone is the right view. And whilst the deeds and their results roll on, based on conditions, all of them, there no beginning can be seen, just as with the seed and the tree. So I'm going to leave this one thing, no beginning and nothing, no one, no soul that's going, just the process. Thank you very much.
If there is no self, from whence can or does volition arise?
The volition is part of the mental stream. Where does consciousness come from? It's just a conditioned phenomenon. Will is just one of the mental factors associated with mentality. It continues because of ignorance. If you wish, it comes from ignorance. But in Buddhism, there is no one cause, no one original cause. It doesn't, again, it's all in, if you say this cause, then you have to say, what causes that? So, you know, the will, as long as there is ignorance, there's the thirst to be an experience, this is where the will or the volitions come from, the volitions that generate karma. That's where it comes from. Okay, well, where does this ignorance come from? So it's a circle that backs on itself. It comes from lack of insight. Why is there lack of insight? Because we are ignorant, because the mind does not see reality. The mind is unable to perceive clearly the true nature of this experience. And so it is, Buddhism does not point to a beginning or an original cause. It usually points to ignorance. So if you have to talk about, but it's not like the original, it's just existence implies this ignorance. Otherwise, you wouldn't be, or we wouldn't be. Existence wouldn't be without ignorance. So when this is a, you know, you think, well, that's kind of a, goes around in a circle. But then everybody's goes around, you know, the idea that existence comes out of some perfect state, you know, that somehow from perfection, the unconditioned generates the conditioned. I mean, that's to me even more bizarre, because the condition doesn't, the unconditioned doesn't generate anything. It doesn't do anything. It's stupid to even think about the unconditioned, all of the thinking to generate. So existence is, that's where Buddhism starts, existence is. This existence operates with these laws. It's fed and maintained because ignorance. It is because of ignorance, and it's fed and maintained because of ignorance. So there is no one there, but there is the process. The process is there. It doesn't require a doer. It doesn't require somebody be, it doesn't require, thinking takes place. It doesn't require the one thinking, willing. These are in themselves, that's what it is. It's not like somebody behind there. Aha, who's pulling this? Because we put that there. Who's thinking? There's no one who's thinking, there's thinking. Who's willing? There's willing. It's just, that's what it is. It's the who is irrelevant. Or it's just some poor eyesight, I guess.
Any ideas on what the transport mechanism or medium is involved in this transfer of karma to the rebirth consciousness?
I would have to defer that to some quantum mechanics scientists who can explain that sort of theory. I cannot explain it because I don't know how what is transferred? How does it transfer? How does the condition cause create that, and yet there's nothing that you can say is measurably transferred. It's just the process. There's nothing that we can measure. There is nothing that we can point to, but there is the causality of it. That's what, can I explain it? I cannot explain it. But I, you know, when at the National Summer Convention, when Goswami gave his lecture, he pointed to this, and I should have looked up his lecture. I can't remember clearly, but he talked about this, the quantum mechanics of the states of the energy levels of the electrons around the nucleus of an atom, and the quantum mechanic view of it, how, you know, an electron is at one point at a certain energy level, and then it's at another one. And nothing is, you know, it's not like it traveled there, it was there and then it's there. And it, something obviously happened, but what? So it's a conditional relationship, but it's not something that you can measure or, you know, people always try to, you know, let's see how we can measure the weight of the soul when it leaves the body. Or there are other things that we can't really say why. Like, is it kinesthetic? What is it when people can move objects with their mind?
Telekinesis.
And, you know, it seems that it's got sufficient credibility these days. Or ESP, you know, where people can actually, they know what somebody else is thinking. A lot of this has got quite a lot of scientific and general acceptability and credibility without there being some measurable way to what is transferred? What maybe there is, it doesn't, there is nothing that's transferred. There's just a relationship between a cause and a result. And it's not a thing.
If the mind can in some way, see countless past lives, then it implies that the past is still in some way present. And if the mind can access it, why can't consciousness access it? And why are we always reborn some point in the future? That seems widely assumed, but I don't know that there's anything concrete to back up that we can't be reincarnated at some point in the past.
Again, this is, I feel a little beyond my scope of knowledge because it is beyond, understanding at an intellectual or a conceptual level. But the idea is put forward that the future and the present and the past exist at the same time, or that maybe the future is already there. I don't want to dismiss it. It's something that I cannot comprehend, but I also am humble enough to say that, time is a relative thing. And so these terms, future and past, are conventional terms. And maybe the reality is something that's different than what I'm conceiving. But the Buddhist teachings were presented in this format of there being past and present and future. And I find that a system of explanation that works for me. In terms of a rebirth, like going back in time, I'm not going to say, no, that's ridiculous. But on the other hand, it just would be difficult, I think, to find that within the Buddhist teachings. It's not there. It's presented in a way that it seems to be more linear. But maybe it's just for simplicity. And the reality,
no way anyone could have grasped it.
Right. And the reality of this thing is maybe beyond what we can conceive of. In terms of the, not only the linear, they're being reborn going forward, I have heard these people who do, they start off by saying doing past life regressions, where people remember their past lives, but now they do these future life progression. So they actually get you to, I guess, remember your future lives or see. And that is difficult for me to accept that because it tends to, and I can, again, with humility say that maybe I just don't understand it well enough how time works. But I'm very wary of anything that suggests a deterministic element, that suggests that things have to be, that suggests that it's already laid out, that it is already so. That is a dangerous understanding. That is a really dangerous understanding because it undermines the motivation for really applying yourself. And so for that one reason, I prefer to think of the future is unknown. It cannot be known. Because if it was knowable and is known, it's already fixed. Unless you say, well, it's knowable as it is now, but it's continually changing. Well, that's all right then, because it's continually changing and can be anything. So, Just on that point, most Buddhists, traditional Buddhists, do attribute to the Buddha omniscience, that he omniscience, all-knowing. And if you attribute that, then you would have to attribute knowing everything, past, present, future, which is You know, that's if that is so, if that is the true, it must be very different than what we're thinking of. It must be really different, because the future, it cannot be fixed. That's all I can say. It cannot be predetermined. It cannot be fatalistic or fixed, because that would be counter to the Buddhist teaching, where volition is very important. Will is very important. Will may not be free will, but it is will that you choose. Free in the sense that it is conditioned, but it's not unconditioned, it's conditioned. But there is choice as a factor. It is a critical factor. Without it, I don't think the spiritual life is possible.